This is Thinkinclusive. I'm Tim Villegas. If I say the acronym ECTA, does that mean anything to you? What if I say Early Childhood Technical Assistance Center? Does that ring any bells? On this week's episode, our guests are the co-directors of the ECTA Center. And if you're a fan of inclusive early childhood education, you're going to love this conversation. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Welcome back to Think Inclusive, where each week we bring you conversations about inclusive education and what inclusion looks like in the real world. I'm so glad you hit play on this episode because for the next 2 episodes, we are putting a spotlight on early childhood education. And not only that, but inclusive early childhood education. Here's a little bit about our guests. Christina Kasperzak is a renowned leader in early intervention and special education. As the director of the Trojanis Technical Assistance Projects at Frank Porter Graham Child Development Institute, University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, she has been pivotal in enhancing services for young children and their families. With over 15 years in program evaluation, Christina co-directs the ECTA Center and leads the DAISY Center, a National Technical Assistance Center that works with states to support IDEA, early intervention, and early childhood special education state programs. She's a co-author on guides on cultural and linguistic diversity in early childhood and is dedicated to promoting anti-racist and equitable practices in the field. Her work is instrumental in shaping effective, inclusive systems for children with disabilities, ensuring every child and family receives equitable opportunities and outcomes. Dr. Megan Vinn is a transformative leader and advocate for inclusive education. At the Frank Porter Graham Child Development Institute, University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, she spearheads initiatives to reform early care systems for children with disabilities. As co-director of both the STEMI and ECTA centers, Dr. Vinn's experience in program evaluation drives systemic change towards equity. Her efforts focus on reducing disparities and fostering inclusive environments in early education. A published author and former CEC, Division of Early Childhood Executive Board member, her work is a testament to her commitment to equity and community in early childhood education. In this episode of Think Inclusive, we discuss the importance of inclusive education for young learners with disabilities and how the ECTA Center supports state administrators in developing equitable and effective systems. We also highlight the indicators of high-quality inclusion and share success stories from communities that have embraced inclusive practices. Before we get into today's conversation, a special thanks to the Early Childhood Technical Assistance Center and the Frank Porter Graham Child Development Institute for collaborating on bringing more content focusing on inclusion in early childhood education. And now, my conversation with Christina Kasperzak and Dr. Megan Vinn. And stay tuned for free time this week for a message from self-advocate Hannah Brammer, part of the Together We're Better campaign, brought to you by the ARC of Maryland, the Maryland State Department of Education, the Maryland Developmental Disabilities Council, and the Maryland Department of Disabilities. Christina Kasperzak and Megan Vinn, welcome to You Think Inclusive.
Thanks for having us. We're excited to be here.
Thank you. Appreciate being here.
Christina and Megan, you are the co-directors for the Early Childhood Technical Assistance Center. And we've already had a couple episodes about the ECTA and kind of previewing what it is. But I'd love for us to start our conversation with, what is the best way for listeners to understand what the ECTA does to support educators and families?
Well, Tim, this is Christina, and I will answer first, if that's okay with Megan. And I'll just say in the most simple terms, ECTA supports state administrators who are leading early intervention and preschool special education programs. So they're working on developing more equitable, effective, and sustainable state systems so that every child with a disability and their family have full access and participation in services. And so I'll just back up and say, if we want children and families to have equitable access and high-quality services, we don't just need the teachers and practitioners with the right knowledge and skills and attitudes, but we need our systems to support them in order to doing those effective practices. And by that, I'm thinking about the infrastructure. So our state and local administrators work on policies and procedures and funding, things like program standards, professional development, other areas of infrastructure like accountability. We need all of these infrastructure areas to support evidence-informed practices to be happening at the local level. And so I'll just say, we as ECTA help those administrators who are continuously working on making sure those systems are supporting local evidence-based practices. Now, before I finish, I want to say we do have some things that are directly for practitioners and families, even though in general we support the infrastructure. So we have some things like practice guides and checklists, some video materials. So we do have some things that directly support practitioners and families. But in general, we're really trying to build that tool belt for administrators to be supporting the practitioners and families.
Megan, do you want to add anything?
No, I think she hit all the high points. I think I would just say that, really, and I know Christina said this, but something that, and actually I know we're going to get into throughout this conversation, is really thinking, though, about at all levels of the system, how do we center equity and inclusion and make sure that we really are thinking about, even if we work at a systems level, I think that sometimes we feel maybe removed from children and families, but the whole point is to really think about how we can build or enhance or think about the early care and education system in a way that's going to hopefully support implementation of practice and then really support improved outcomes for kids and families.
Okay, so I have a question about supporting infrastructure.
Mm-hmm.
Is is your connection to, you know, the, I would imagine it's state departments of education. Is that right? Or who is your main contact in a state? For instance, I live in Georgia. Our nonprofit MCIE is in Maryland. You know, we have a number of relationships with different state departments of education. Is there like a liaison between the state and ECTA, or is it less formal than that?
It's in general formalized, that in the State Department of Education, there's usually somebody in charge of the preschool 619 program. So they are a point person that we connect with most often for the preschool special ed. And then, of course, we also support early intervention. And so there's a lead agency, and that is appointed by the governor. And so the lead agency has a Part C or early intervention coordinator, and they are our point person for the state EI program.
And not to complicate it, but our systems wouldn't be systems if they weren't complicated. The early intervention system, or the folks on birth to two, may or may not be in the Department of Education. Often it's not. Sometimes it's in like Health and Human Services or some other department in the state, which is why, when we get into inclusion, we're going to talk, I think, a lot of the things I was thinking about, talk about collaboration across these systems. So.
Okay. And again, I just asked to help clarify. And because when we think about technical assistance, I'm not sure everyone understands what that actually means. Like, so we have a national center. We have the center, right, that supports every state. But then exactly what does that support look like? And before we get too far, you said that there are some guides for practitioners and families. Are there any guides on top of mind that are like just really popular that a lot of people access and download?
Yes, actually, the practitioner checklists and guides, and then there's a family guides companion. Those are corresponding to the DEC recommended practices. So there's ones on the different areas under DEC. So instruction and assessment and family. I think it's called family in general, but it's like got family engagement. And so there's like a really terrific set that practitioners can use for themselves. And then they can have a companion piece that they can actually hand a family member. That really is something like if you're at the IFSP or IEP, you may find it appropriate to hand the family member a resource that's short, but has some specific things they might want to do to support their child. Might be like around social emotional or other areas of learning. And it also will have most of them, if not all, I can't remember, have like a video clip that also goes with them. So it's trying to be short and concise and very family friendly. And we're hoping that practitioners will give those to families at like sort of an appropriate time. If a family's working on something particular, that might be a tool or a resource they can hand the family. Now, of course, families can go on the website and look at for those themselves, which we would certainly encourage. But we also know that they depend on their IFSP and IEP teams to try to point them in the specific area that they're working on or where they might need resources the most.
Okay, great. Don't want to cut you off, Megan, if you wanted to say anything else, or we can move on.
Well, either sign, because I think we're going to get into some of the other resources. I have put some other ones in where we have a series, or it's not a series, it's a tool, and it's for different levels of the system, but we have a tool for the indicators of high quality inclusion, and I was going to talk about that later, so I don't want to steal the thunder yet.
Okay, we can talk about that later.
I think we'll also maybe talk to, I was going to put a plug in for, we have other centers that are funded through the Department of Education that ECTA collaborates with that also have resources, like the parent centers are a great resource for families. I'm also the co-director of the STEM Innovation for Inclusion in Early Education, or STEMI Center, which a lot of our resources are for practitioners and families, and really thinking about how you can do practical and inclusive STEM within your routines, within what you're already doing. And so we could share some of those too that you could link, or however that works within a podcast.
Okay, great. What I would like to know next, I'd love to know why inclusive education for young learners with disabilities is important to you, both of you. You know, we get into this work typically because it's a passion of ours. Mm-hmm. And so I'd love to know who'd like to go first to answer that question.
Megan, you want to go first on this one?
Yeah. Well, so you made me think, I had thought about some things related to this question I know before. And I'm going to digress a little. So I think I often think about myself, if I'm thinking about my personal journey, you know, how I really came to this field. I had a grandfather that had polio, and my younger sister, when she was born, was 2 months premature and in a trach and feeding tube. And so for me, I think disability has always just been a part of my life, right? It's an important part. And so as I was really thinking about this question, I was kind of coming at it from, you know, inclusion is a human right. And I think it's really critical because the alternative is exclusion, right? And I think, you know, I could share all the benefits of inclusion for both children with disabilities and children without. And there are a lot of benefits, right, that have been documented through research and experience. And they've been documented, I think, for a really long time. But I do, one of the things I was thinking about as I was looking at this question before is sometimes I think we're asking the wrong question, because as educators and practitioners, whatever you want to say, as society, I think we should be asking why we are so comfortable with exclusion and with allowing ableism and racism to continue to grow and thrive within our early care and education environments. And so I often think about the question is like, how do we change our system and practices to really ensure each and every child with a disability feels belonging within our communities? And that we're really making sure we're centering those that have been most harmed within our system. So that was where I sort of went, is really thinking about, like, for example, we know that Black children with disabilities are the least likely to include it. So how do we change that question so that it's not about defending why or why not we should do inclusion, but really saying, how do we make change and ensure we stop doing harm to children and families that we serve, and making sure that we're getting at, we're no longer going to exclude, that inclusion is just our way of being. So that was sort of what I thought about as I said this question.
I love that.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you for sharing that.
Yeah.
Yeah, great answer, Megan.
Follow,
I love it.
Follow that up, Christina.
I know.
Over to you.
Yeah. Well, I would approach this question from a personal sense as well. I'll just start by saying I just fundamentally believe that each of us desires and deserves to feel valued, having meaningful connection with others, and to feel that sense of belonging. And so if you start with that, I think, we do know from research that inclusion benefits all children, children with disabilities and children without disabilities. So helping everyone have that sense of belonging and connection. I feel like that fundamental belief of mine also comes from my upbringing. I was really lucky enough to have parents who valued all people and served really as role models for me and my sisters with regard to building friendships, with folks who were different than us and treating everyone in our community with respect. And I know my parents were also strong believers in education as this critical path to opening your mind, as well as opening opportunities for success and happiness in life. So just circling back to thinking about the importance of inclusive education, you know, I think how it offers opportunity long-term for success and happiness in life, but short-term, right in that moment, it offers that human connection, the opportunity to have friendship and community and belonging with everyone in that classroom or whatever environment they're served in. And I just think that's a fundamental right, like Megan said. And it's something we need to offer each and every child, both children with and without disabilities.
Thank you for sharing that. Something this is making me think of, you know, when I was a classroom teacher in, you know, in the day-to-day working in schools and with children, and a believer in inclusion and inclusive practices, a lot of times I felt alone, right? I felt like I was the only one talking about inclusion in my building, the way that we are talking about it. So whoever's listening, I just want to direct them and kind of focus that here we have co-directors of a National Technical Assistance Center that are talking about inclusion and belonging and how we can restructure our systems to benefit all learners. And I feel like that's a huge win. And that the thing is, you know, the people that I've talked to that are at the national level around special education often are talking about inclusion and equity and education for all in these terms. So if you're out there feeling like you're alone, you're not. You're not. And you also have partners in this thinking and that are really trying to make change. So thank you for sharing your hearts with regard to that. I really appreciate it.
Tim, can I add, since you brought that up?
Yeah.
I was thinking about, again, then about the infrastructure. And that's because I think a lot of people, when they think that the special ed or early intervention isn't maybe working right, or they think about, let's train practitioners. And I don't mean that the training for the providers and teachers isn't important, but they don't necessarily think about, well, maybe those people know exactly what to do, but they have barriers that are like, well, we can't get paid for doing this, which is best practice, or we don't have the right policies to support us going into like professional, getting paid for professional development. Or, you know, there's a bunch of ways that that system has to support practitioners that may have all the right knowledge and skills and attitudes. And that's where like that system infrastructure can sometimes be a barrier. So, you know, speaking to those who are in a classroom or in a setting where they feel alone, it may be that they know what to do, and maybe we need to work on raising up what are the barriers to your local administrators about what's preventing you from doing what you know is best for kids and families.
Megan?
Yeah, and I was thinking as you were talking too, you know, I think that's a really important point you made too about like how you can feel, it can be really disheartening and you can feel like you're on an island by yourself. And I know as I think about what's worked, right, it's like finding your community or people that are really going to be at the core saying, we center this. How do we do it? Let's problem solve these barriers, because I think it's never going to be a perfect system, right? I think like if it was, or we knew how to do it, we would have done it, right? But I really think it's about, and I love that you said this, because I know I even think sometimes, I know, Christina, we've talked about this and I've talked about this with other colleagues, like, how do we find those people that are willing to sort of work together around this and problem solve it? Hopefully we can then move out to all the, you know, all the people who maybe aren't as excited about inclusion as we are. But I still think there's this way of like really finding those people and really building up that collaboration. And that's really important. And I love what you said, that for folks listening, you know, there are lots of people, I think, who are doing this work. And how do we come together to really say, this is what we just should be doing? And not that we have to defend it or continue to keep saying, well, this is why it's great. But to say, this is just what we should be doing. And let's create a system that just is that. And I know, Christina, we always talk about it, that we recognize we don't know what that looks like, right? Because we have never had a just or fully inclusive or fully equitable system. And so that's why it's really important that we do this work together, and why collaboration is so critical to this work and finding those systems and people who are going to, you know, be there to do it with you.
Might be a perfect opportunity to also share, you know, as Megan said, we have partners all over the country. Some of them are TA partners, but also like the Division for Early Childhood, the Council for Exceptional Children is a perfect home for practitioners and teachers and providers mm-hmm. who want to work together to say, what does high quality inclusion look like? What kind of strategies are you using? What barriers are you running into, and how are you dealing with that? And so there's, and I think there's divisions within most states. And so there's the National Division for Early Childhood, but then there's also chapters. Is that what it's called, Megan, in each state?
Yeah. I can't remember if it's chapters or what, but your state has a thing.
Yeah.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
With your work in the ECTA, are there particular bright spots across the United States with regard to early childhood inclusion?
Yeah. I love this question because I think sometimes we can get mired in, which is important, right? In the lack of change and growth. I mean, in early childhood, the data hasn't changed in a really, really long time on inclusion. Yeah, we know that there are places who are really doing good work. So I love that you're talking about the bright spots. And I think there are lots of, one of the things we're seeing is, and don't hear me saying the state's not important, because we work with states and I think the state level is really important. But communities are really where the rubber seems to hit the road, and how we can help people within communities to come together to embrace inclusion. I think that's where we're seeing a really bright spot. And so what we're seeing is, public preschool and special education, childcare, Head Start, or whatever the programs are within your community are coming together, that allows them to also really think about how they can problem solve some maybe really big issues, but there's some leverage points there. And so, like, for example, maybe we're seeing communities who are using funding in different ways, don't be wrong, we would love to increase funding. I think that's important, but that's one of the myths is that inclusion is more costly. It's not more costly. We just have to use our funds in maybe different ways. And so, like, for example, how we maybe stop busing kids between programs and find ways to bring services to where kids are. So I digressed a little. But at ECTA, I know I said this earlier, is that we've developed these indicators of high quality inclusion. And there are four sets. There's the state, community, local program, and then what we've called the early care and education environment indicators, which are sort of the classroom practices or what you do with kids and families. But I think one of the things we heard when we were developing them is that not everybody calls themselves a classroom. And so how do we really make sure that everyone sees themselves in the conversation and that we're using the right language? But in any case, the state, community, and local programs sort of show what infrastructure is needed to ensure that we're implementing those early care and education environment indicators or those inclusion classroom practices. And so I wanted to share that we've worked with a couple of states who've utilized these indicators And again, the communities have really, the states have done some amazing work to really think about what their communities need. But we worked with Illinois and Oregon, and their communities have made some really great gains. And actually, one of the things I thought I could share is one of the communities in Illinois actually hosted a series of podcasts that really shared their journeys. And so that might be something that's really important that we could share with listeners is how they access some of those podcasts, because they shared some of the work that they did as a community to problem solve. And then the other thing I wanted to mention, and again, there are lots of great programs, so I don't want to say that there aren't, but I wanted to really share that there's this really awesome program in Denver called the Rive School of Denver, who's really fully committed to inclusion. It's part of their mission and vision. And in doing that work, they've really centered children with disabilities as part of their approach. And I know one of the things we've seen in our field is everyone's probably facing, is we're facing huge turnover. And even in the face of that turnover, because they've put some systems and processes in place and coaching, it has ensured that their inclusion continues to thrive even in the face of that turnover. And so I could go on and on because I think there are lots of bright spots. But I think the most important message is that when it's something we value, we will do it, right? Because there's always going to be challenges and barriers to anything we do in early childhood or anything we do in school age. But I think if we really try to value it, it's like the curb cut effect, that really thinking about being proactive on inclusive design means we all, I'm going to say quote unquote win, is that we all really get what we need if we start with really centering the children we have most excluded, is what I would say.
I was wondering if it might be interesting to just share a little bit, like if you're looking at the early care and education environment indicators, we're talking about things like what do providers do around things like family partnership? So how are you creating an environment for two-way communication with families? How are you involving families in activities according to their desire and ability? So family partnerships is something, social emotional learning and development, meaningful interactions with peers. And we have like really kind of specific activities or that practitioners or providers can do related to teaming and supporting dual language learners, all of those kinds of things. And then as Megan said, the other community and local system and state system indicators relate to what they're doing to support those things with policies, with funding, you know, with standards. So there's some really practical items in there that can be used to self-assess how am I doing, as well as to say like, oh, these are some specifics that I can do or we can do as a team. So I think those are very practical tools that can be used, as Megan said, at all different levels of the system.
And I think the hope is that also we don't put it all on the backs of practitioners and families, right? It's how do we really showcase that there are things we need to put in place to make sure that you can do, that you can effectively serve all the children and families within your community. And so like, I think I was going back, Tim, to what you said earlier about like, you can feel alone. Sometimes it's because we make the onus on the teacher or on the family to just know what they don't know, or to do stuff without any support. And so I think that's really one of the things we hope comes with the indicators, is showcasing that it really is part of a bigger system. And we hope people will use the practices, like you said, Christine, the really practical. We just did a revision that should be out, I'm going to say fingers crossed, by the end of this year, that really one of the things we did is we knew that we implicitly had things around equity embedded, but now it's explicit. So you'll see some more things have been added really around, I want to highlight like identity affirming practices, like how can we make sure that every child really feels like they belong in our classroom and that we see them for who they are versus maybe who we want them to be. And so I really think there's some things around that have been included that are going to be really important within this conversation as well.
I wanted to circle back to what you said about the district in Illinois, the podcast. So if you can, you know, just send me or give me the name of the, it's not East Moline, is it?
No, hold on. Let me find it. I actually had it up and now it looks like I've shut my tab so nothing would ding, which doesn't help you right now, but I will find it and send it to you.
Because, you can just send it to me and then that way we can include it in the resources, links in the show notes. And then the same thing for the school in Denver. So the Rye School is, aren't those schools, like, aren't there different ones in different states? Because I believe there's a rise in Austin.
Yeah, I'm going to be honest. I don't know actually how they're connected, but I do, because I've worked more with, or I work with, we have a partner from one of the folks in Denver. And they, again, if I'm not that I'm promoting all this other work, but they were one of our STEMI sites as well. I don't know exactly how they're all connected, but I do know that the one in Denver and probably others are really doing some amazing work that is showcasing. And they've allowed us, I'll say, like, for STEMI to capture some videos on what does it really look like to be inclusive, right? And I think it is our way of being, right? It's like about normalizing supports that, like, we all require supports, you know, as an adult. It's not about saying, like, how do we wean kids off of support so they're fully independent, because that's not reality, right? I think about, even as I'm having this conversation with you, I have my fidgets and all the things that I use to make sure that I'm, you know, focused and paying attention. And I think they've just done an amazing job, I think, at really showcasing what it could look like to be inclusive, and how it looks like to truly center it, even if things are hard and you have challenges. And, you know, like, part of that is, like, having those conversations that maybe make people feel uncomfortable. And really being a part of that system. So anyway, I can't sing their praises enough. And actually, if you think about it, we could give you names of maybe folks who might come onto your podcast and share of the work they're doing. They're really doing great work.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I'd love it. So in your experience with working with, you know, state and district leaders, what do you think would be, like, the most effective strategy on how to have a system move towards inclusive practices?
You know, something that came to mind is, like, you were talking, I think, and I know we've sort of said this, and I think the more we can dismantle the silos we have in an early care and education system, that's going to be really critical. You know, we have, like, our funding streams and that are different, our people are different, they're in different, you know, programs, departments. And I think we're seeing that system is really making it challenging at the end of the day for kids to get what they need where they already are, you know, whether that is their childcare head start. And so I think that's one thing, is, like, how do we continue to educate for some of the, like, asking states and systems to really think about how they de-silo. But I think the other part of your question, and I don't know if I'm jumping, I was thinking a lot about your question related to advocacy, which I think is part of this, and the importance of, like you were saying, you know, families and self-advocates have done, you know, really, there's a power there. I think there have been, right? Like, that's how we got the Americans with Disabilities Education Act and the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, is people advocated. And so I was thinking, though, about, as part of your question, is also how do we make sure that we're thinking about families of children with disabilities and how we're thinking about people with disabilities and making sure that they have a voice, right, in this conversation, and really listening to what they say is the way we should move our system. I think we don't pull disabled advocates in enough to these conversations and people with disabilities. And so really, that to me is one of the things that we miss a lot within our state efforts, is that we or even in our community efforts, is how do we make sure that people with disabilities are involved? And I think you'll see that in the indicators. That's one of the things we really strengthened, was making sure that as you're developing teams, you're pulling in people with disabilities who have gone through our systems and know what needs to change that we maybe aren't listening to. And I think the last thing I'll say, I'm sure it's not the last thing I'll say, but the last thing for this question that I'll say is also, how do we really get to a system that doesn't require you to know what you don't know, and that requires the onus to be on families to just know and figure it out? And so I keep coming back to, like, that's why it's so important to pull in disabled advocates and others who could help say how the system could change, because we have made it so that we require a great deal from families of children with disabilities, is that you have to know what you don't know. Like, you have to know how to get services, or you have to know to push for inclusion, or you have to know where, like, you know, all these great resources are that can help you advocate for why inclusion is important. And so, like, how do we really put the onus back on the system to stop maybe blaming individuals, and really as a state or a local program, or I would say at the federal level, there's a place for that there too, is really looking at why we continue to exclude so many kids, and really think about what it would look like not to do that. I think, yeah.
You know, all right. I was thinking about a couple things too. I love what you said, Megan. So I'll see if I can add anything of value. I was thinking about, how do we empower everybody to lead from where they are? So there's not leaders and non-leaders in the state. It's like, you are a leader from wherever you are. And I'll reiterate what Megan said about family leaders and family advocacy groups, and how powerful those can be for making sure that their kids and all kids have opportunity and engagement and are included with their peers. I would say that practitioners need to see themselves as leaders. And if everybody's not doing what you're doing, how is it that actually maybe you're ahead and you find others who are actually leaders in the field and helping to pave the way? I would say the system, as we've been talking about, was not designed for all kids. It wasn't designed for kids with disabilities. It actually wasn't designed for Black and Brown children. It wasn't designed for multilingual learners. And so we are trying to think about, how do we rethink about a system that actually welcomes and engages all of these children? And so it really does take us to be leading from wherever you sit, whatever your strengths are, whatever your position is, how are you moving this forward? And just thinking about the de-siloing, the partnering, the advocacy, and also we have to advocate for funding. We have to advocate for fully funding the federal level, local level. What is it that makes sure we have the resources, people, and funds to implement what we know is quality for kids and families?
And I know, so I said that was the last thing I would say, but I lied. I do think something that I was thinking about as we talk about it, systems change, also is, how do we really, what does it really look like to sort of confront the ableism in our system? You know, I mean, that is a huge part of this, you know, and the ableism and racism within our system. And so for me, really, like, I think that's going to, I just keep coming back to, how do we as a system really look at that? And, like, we want to go towards inclusion, but we're going to have some discomfort around really, like you said, Christina, looking at who was our system created for? And how do we recognize that it was created with really ableist and racist roots, and that those continue to thrive? And so part of that is going to be, and I think in a really good way, right? Like, you're not growing if you're not uncomfortable in learning. So part of it is us really coming together to look at and really question, like, why are some of these things set up the way they are? And how do we change them? Because it doesn't have to be this way, right? It's this way because it's always been this way. Not because it actually has to be the way the system functions. I'm not saying it's not hard, so don't hear me say that, because it's definitely going to be hard. But I think it's, you know, time that we use the words, right? We use ableism and racism and really make sure that we're thinking about how we make changes to our system.
You know, sorry, maybe we're just interrupting too much, Tim, but I was just thinking this circles back to one of the things Megan and I were both saying at the beginning of the interview, and that is inclusion is good for all kids. And so I don't want parents or practitioners or principals or whoever to think by doing inclusion, we're helping the kids with disabilities and not all kids. That's one of the things that there shouldn't be the fear of that. It actually is great for learning and empathy and development and friendship for all of these kids. And so I think there's sometimes that's a myth that it's only good for the kids with disabilities. And I think that could really help change attitudes and help people really invest more in understanding we want what's best for all of our children. Mm-hmm.
It's the curb cut effect, right? Like I think, I don't know if our listeners, you may or may not know the curb cut effect, but you use them every day. You know, those cuts that are in curbs when you go up to a crosswalk, you know, those were advocated for with people with disabilities, right? And how often do we all use curb cuts and they make our lives easier, right? And so I think your point's really important, Christina. That helps all of us because we've designed for people with disabilities. We've designed proactively and intentionally designed that way. And everybody uses curb cuts all the time. And maybe that's, we can share some resources on that too. But I think that's a really important reminder is when we design for people with disabilities, it helps us all. It's not just for, you know, a lot of those practices that we have in our indicators of high quality inclusion. I think when we talk to people, a lot of them are just good practice, right? We should be making kids and families feel like they belong in our systems with or without disabilities, right? So when we're using those practices and centering that, that really does benefit everyone.
So what I'm hearing y'all say is if you are a educator or a, you know, and I love, Christina, you talked about, you know, everyone is a leader. Everyone, mm-hmm. everyone can lead where they are. I encourage everyone who is interested in what the ECTA does is to take a look at those quality indicators. Do, you know, a self-assessment to figure out, well, how is my community doing on these areas? And then share that with maybe someone who can do something mm-hmm. about that. If you feel like you can't do something about that, alone, share that with a director or somebody at the school district or at the center that your learner goes to or that you work at, and let's see what we can do about changing things.
Yeah, like we all have a sphere of influence, right? There's work on that. We talk about that a lot, as you were saying, Christina. Sometimes we feel like we hold limited power. I think it goes back to what you're saying about feeling maybe like you're alone, but we all have a sphere of influence. There are ways that we can create change. Doesn't have to just, you know, like you said, it doesn't have to be like the biggest change ever. There are ways within your sphere of influence or where you are in the situated that you can make change. And so I love what you're saying about, you know, there are ways for you to look at these resources and share them with other people who maybe you feel like you said, a director or principal who maybe has more power, or to think about what are your own practices and how you make change. So I really love that. Everybody has some type of influence from wherever they're situated.
Right after a short break, the mystery question.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Would you choose a shorter life and be super rich, or a longer life? I think this grammar is wrong. Would you choose a shorter life and be super rich, or a longer life and be somewhat poor?
It's so funny.
Oh, you're that one's so easy.
But it's so funny you're asking me this, because my son has been asking me these types of questions. And this is one.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah. And this is where one of the questions he asked, he did not like my answer. Because I was like, my husband and I also both answered this, but it was like, I don't know which would you pick, Christina? I can't remember what I said. I like the idea of being rich, I'm not going to lie. but I also don't know how short your life. How short are we talking short?
It just says shorter.
My son didn't like all the additional questions I had. We're like, could you be have a longer life and be poor and eventually make more money? Like, these are the questions that we asked him. And he didn't
well,
like
it also says somewhat poor. Yeah. So I think it's relative. Like, if you live in the United States,
yes,
right? You live at the poverty line, you're still richer than like the majority of the world. So
yeah.
Well, for me it's easy, although I could see someone figuring out how a shorter life and fun with money could be better. But for me, a longer life and being poorer or somewhat poorer, it means that so for me, the most important thing in my life is spending time with family. Mm-hmm. So I think that is being rich. And I also think a longer life means opportunity for personal, spiritual, community mm-hmm. growth. And so the only way I could ever pick rich would be I would end up donating all that money to support other people. And then I would be poor again. So I'm not quite sure how that would work for me. Megan.
That's a you answer for sure. I think I agree. I think I would pick the longer life, because I also think, and this is why my son hated all my answers, was because change is kind of our only constant, right? So being able to see growth and change, and like you said, spend time with family and friends. I'm assuming their life would also be longer, is maybe the hope as well. And then there is always opportunity for change and growth. So for me, I think I would agree with you. I'd pick that. Although my son didn't like all the caveats that I had, but I do agree with you. I think that would be important. Yeah. Yeah.
Yes. Yes. And I would agree with both of you, longer life, even though, you know, it would be somewhat poor. Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, not to get all deep and heavy here. So I apologize, but when I think about like end of life, and you know, You know, whether or not that is scary or not. I think the biggest thing that I think about at, you know, about the end, you know, of my life is that I won't know what happens after. Anyways, it's just something that I've talked about this with my friends. You know, it's not so much the dying part, but although that does, you know, the unknown and all that stuff, but like, you know, that I won't know like what happens 100 years from now, like what else, you know, what new innovations and what new things happen and like how far our inclusion advocacy will go and like, you know, like what will happen.
Yeah.
So I like knowing the end of the story. Yeah. And so that bothers me a little bit. So the longer I can have the story, the longer I can have, the better.
Yeah. It's that fear of missing out, right? That fear of missing out.
Yeah.
I appreciate that.
Christina Kaspersak, Megan Vinn, thank you so much for being on the Think Inclusive podcast.
Thanks for having
us. Thank you, Tim.
That chime means it's free time. This week, I wanted to share a message from Hannah Brammer, who talks about her experience growing up with a disability. This is originally from a video produced for the Together We're Better Inclusive Education campaign from the ARC of Maryland. Here's Hannah.
Together We're Better from the ARC Maryland. Inclusion is the act or practice of including and accommodating people who have historically been excluded as because of their race, gender, sexuality, or ability.
So, hi, my name is Hannah Brammer. I am 20 years old. I was born with osteogenesis imperfecta, also known as OI. I'm from Baltimore County and I live with my family.
What is osteogenesis imperfecta?
So, osteogenesis imperfecta is a developmental disability where our bones are fragile. They're very fragile, especially when you're younger. When you get older, as far as like in my case, when I got older, my bones strengthened, which is good, so I don't fracture as much, but I'm still prone to fracturing if I'm in a dangerous environment.
Growing up, did you attend public school?
Growing up, I was able to go to all public schools with the assistance of an aide to help me with heavy books and doors and whatever else I needed help with. And I went to Winan Elementary, Windsor Mill Middle School, and Owings Mills High School. And I did also do home tutoring when I was able to not go to school, physical school, due to my fractures.
Did you have a lot of friends in school?
Yes, I have friends. It wasn't too hard to make them or have them. My closest friends, they understood about my disability and they didn't allow that to make our friendship any different. So, yeah. In elementary school, I did take a gym class. And since I wasn't able to, I had an accommodation where I went into a separate room with a few of my friends. And since I wasn't able to do the vigorous activities they could do, I played the Wii and did like Wii sports where I did bowling and golf and tennis. And I beat my friends in bowling all the time. And my friends, they didn't mind. They wanted to join me all the time to the point where my teachers had to say like, oh, pick somebody else. Because I kept picking them because they always wanted to play the Wii with me. They preferred to do that besides the like activities the other class was doing.
What can students and schools do to make sure everyone is welcomed and feels included?
What students and schools can do to get people with disabilities involved in the environment, just pay attention to engagement. Make sure you're engaging with them. If you're doing something, include them too. They may want to do it as well. If you're in a class and participation is going on, ask them what's your response to the question. You know, get them involved and make them feel like they're wanted and they're not like left out. And then also too, if they have a physical disability, make sure you're paying attention to accessibility, make sure things are suitable for their needs, and if they're in the wheelchair with their physical disability, make sure things are moved out of the way and everything like that.
How do I talk to someone about their disabilities?
Don't assume anything. You want to make sure you ask somebody if you're curious about their disability, because you never know what people are going through or what they have, so you never want to assume. Always ask. It's okay to ask.
What else do you want students to know about people with disabilities?
Make sure you recognize that people are people first. They're not their disability. Their disability is secondary. You never want to define someone from the disability. So always remember that people are first. And then we also want to have a good life. Just like everybody else, we want good friendships, relationships, to be included and feel loved. People with disabilities did not ask for their disability. It's not up to them. It's just their life. You have to, live with it. Some differences can be seen and others cannot. You can't always see. It's not like visible to the eye. And then also, finally, the number one thing is to be kind to everyone, because you never know what they're going through.
Want to learn more about school inclusion from people with disabilities? Schedule an online presentation by contacting Sharon Doles at sdoles@thearcmd.org. You can also learn more about Together We're Better on our website at www.thearcmd.org. Together We're Better is brought to you by a partnership between The Arc Maryland, the Maryland Department of Disabilities, the Maryland Developmental Disabilities Council, and the Maryland State Department of Education.
That's it for this episode of Think Inclusive. A huge shout out to the ECTA Center for collaborating on this episode. Next week, we will learn from educators in Oregon about how they are prioritizing inclusive early childhood education to benefit all learners. Think Inclusive is written, edited, designed, mixed, and mastered by me, Tim Villegas, and is a production of the Maryland Coalition for Inclusive Education. Original music by Miles Kredich. Additional music from Melody. And a very special thank you to Imogen. She might be one of the only family members that listens to my podcast. Thanks for your time and attention. And remember, inclusion always works. There we go. I got this new phone and I literally don't know how to turn it off. Like with my other phone, I could just hold the power button and it turned off. And this one, I have no idea. So,
well, Tim, I just want you to know that you're making me feel less stressed, because I don't know how to do this. But so far, you had a frog in your throat and your phone rang. So I'm like, okay, I think I can.
Listen,
you're doing that intentionally to make us more relaxed.
I think. I'm a professional podcaster. Okay, I do this for a living.
I love it.
From MCIE.